Hey, it's Big Joe for your trusted local independent America's Standard heating and air conditioning dealer, Reinhardt Heating and Cooling. Owner Danny Reinhardt's daughter, Kim, says her dad has a daily influence on the way customers are treated.
Dad's built a great business, and it's an honor to be able to keep carrying it on, and his work ethic and the way he treats customers, and that's something that I want to carry on and treat people the same way.
You can call on Reinhardt Heating and Cooling at 317-745-4526. Reinhardt is your trusted local independent American Standard dealer.
You're listening to the best of Kevin and Querry on 93.5 and 107.5, The Fan.
Jake, I'm reading this. You know Seth Wickersham, ESPN?
Yes, sir.
How would you kind of characterize him in the sports media world?
The New Orleans Saints. Am I being too critical?
I guess I necessarily wasn't thinking NFL team. When I think Seth Wickersham, and he writes a piece, I think, must read.
Yeah, no.
Okay. Tons of detail.
I thought you meant like in terms of like his, you know, like how often he's like breaking big stories or that kind
of thing. Yeah, I don't think he's like a newsbreaker necessarily.
Okay, how about this? A slightly less ubiquitous and annoying Bill Simmons. Like I love when Bill Simmons first came out, I loved reading him, and then it kind of got to be the same thing over and over and over. And it was like, okay, enough.
Wickersham's latest, Andrew Luck finally reveals why he walked away from the NFL. So I was kind of in the midst of reading that, as you'd expect. Pretty long piece. A little surprised Andrew did that.
What does it say?
I'm in the midst of reading, so I have not gotten to that point yet.
Because,
I don't know, I felt like, you know, he did all that stuff with Zach Kiefer this offseason, off the record, for the podcast. And it just seemed like he was kind of content with that side of it. I don't know, maybe he will say why he feels the need to do it now. I don't know. Having another daughter, I don't know exactly if there was a life event in there or anything like from that realm that he felt the urge to do. Like, why now?
What I heard was, it might have been Zach that mentioned this. I can't recall. But I think there were a couple of things that went into play. And I know it's kind of a tired subject to people around here. I get that. But it's still relevant, obviously, when you're talking about Andrew Luck and why he walked away.
Well, it's the first time we've ever had Luck on the record quotes about,
right,
about it.
Supposedly he was watching something or saw something of a former player in the NFL that was being interviewed and talked about his inability or his difficulty in playing with his children because of injuries, back injuries, and that Luck looked at his own daughter and was like, I'm not going to be that guy. I'm just not. And he had gone through hell in terms of rehab of different injuries. And I know people can talk about the snowboarding accident and all that, but I think the ankle injury in particular, and if you recall late that ankle injury, it was like a rare bone that grows off of the ankle that they would have had to gone in to remove perhaps, and it set him back further on his rehab. I think sometimes we overthink things, Kevin, and I haven't read the article, so I don't know exactly what it says. But here's the thing. I think sometimes we as humans have an ability to overthink things or overcomplicate things. And, you know, just for example, a month ago when I was in Barcelona, I'm walking around Barcelona, and I'm like, this city is so beautiful, like so cool. There was such a cool vibe about it. And, you know, there's obviously kind of a romanticism of being in a different place, in a different culture. And I thought to myself, I can only imagine what it must be like to be 28, 30 years old and know that you have more money than you will ever need and that you can travel to places like this anytime you want and soak it in and learn about it. And Andrew Luck is one of those guys, I think, that wants to learn about everything that he sees and everything that he comes across. And I think that competing was very important to Andrew Luck, but I don't know that competing in football was. I think he liked the game of football. I think he loves to compete, but I don't know that he ever felt like he needed it. And I think that we sometimes have an inability to grasp that because we have a passion about something doesn't mean that those that we're passionate about share the same passion. And for Andrew Luck, that passion, I think it came down to, I have all the money I need. I have the ability to travel around and look at the things that interest me, like old Roman architecture and different cultures and different foods and soccer matches, and ride my bike through Milan and whatever else. And I still have my health, and it's been hell and back to rehab different things, and I'm just not doing it anymore. I mean, am I overthinking it or underthinking it in that case, Kevin?
You know, to sum up why I thought he retired, it was the sacrifices that it took to play the game of football were impacting his personal life too much. He could not compartmentalize the rehab aspect to it, the physical toll with his relationships as at the time, a new husband, a soon-to-be father, all of those things.
Do you believe it's possible? Strictly conjecture. Nothing to base this on. Do you believe it's possible that Andrew Luck was afraid of going back to a place where he was too dependent upon the medication that was being prescribed to him because of all the injuries he'd been through?
Yeah, I don't know that. I don't. You know, I've always said this about the injury. The injury was nothing. You know, it was a calf injury. You compare that on the NFL scale of injuries, it's not like,
well,
this guy needed three surgeries. It's not an Alex Smith type injury that sent him into retirement.
But I believe, Kevin, the last injury, they thought it was a calf injury, and then if you recall, remember at the very end, they discovered that he had, I know this sounds crazy, that the calf injury was being precipitated, if you will, by that like weird bone that was coming off of his ankle.
Yeah, ostrogonum or whatever it's called.
Correct. And they didn't realize that was what was causing the issue, and they basically said like the one you have to go in and have that like shaved down or removed, which was like an outpatient thing but required a lot of recovery time. Ryan Deem had the same thing. I remember that because I remember Ryan Deem talking about it, but not wanting to go like on record, but saying like, yeah, I had the same thing. Like, that's what I had. He was public about the fact he had it, but that was the end of it. But, and then shortly thereafter, like a week later, boom, Luck retired. I think the thought, you know, all of us have different things in life that are valleys that we go through, and we're proud of ourselves for going through them. But then you look back and you go, I don't ever want to go through that again. You know, for me, it's happened like I think for people hearing my voice, the most relatable thing would be if you've ever been in a situation where you are financially in a hole or you lose a job and you fight your way through that and you make ends meet and then you get another job and you get back on your feet again and you start to develop a bit of a nest egg again and you think to yourself, okay, I made it through that. But boy, I don't ever want that uncertainty again. And I think that from an athlete standpoint, you have all the money you need, but your body becomes your checking account. And you're like, man, I don't want to go back through that again. You know, I mean, that's, but again, I think that the hardest thing about sports and the biggest thing that I learned or have learned in my career is I will never forget working locally in television. And when the Colts lost that game to the Pittsburgh Steelers, the Nick Harper, Mike Vanderjagt wide right game, that was the biggest sure feeling in the world that the Colts were going to the Super Bowl that year. I mean, it was they were the most dominant team in football. And they'd broken through, and it was like, oh my gosh, this city is going to have a Super Bowl champion. This is unbelievable. And then they got beat by Pittsburgh. and literally you could feel like they needed to put Prozac in the White River or in the Broderpool Canal, because that's the water supply for the city, and like everyone was depressed. You could feel the life come out of the city. And that night I was working in local television, and we had three different players, I've told this story before, that came in that night, kudos to them, to do our Sunday night, or it might have been a Saturday night, show in studio. And while Dave First and I are feverishly editing together the final pieces of the show itself, the three players that were coming in studio came in and asked to use my computer, and they were all three of them looking up vacations for the next day and booking their flights to like Tahiti and Dominican Republic. And they're like, man, where are you going? And I remember thinking like, holy cow, this city is devastated. And sure, they were disappointed, don't get me wrong, but vacation came early for them. And that's when I realized that oftentimes we emotionally invest in things that forces we as people to believe that everyone has that same emotional investment. And I'm not saying Andrew Luck didn't care as an athlete, but I also think that Andrew Luck's bar of what was necessary for him to be a content human being probably was raised or lowered by different things than that of people that had Andrew Luck being the one that was affecting their bar. And that's a very hard thing for me and other people, I think, to grasp.
Yeah, and I've got no issue with, you know, guys when the season ends, that's what they're doing. I mean, I think it's an incredible grind, physical toll on your body, mental grind, to endure an NFL season. And for it to end like that, you do want to get away. I think it's kind of hard to fully relate to, because our jobs are not that necessarily, you know, matching up with that exact physical grind. And for a lot of these guys, again, Indianapolis necessarily isn't home during the season either. So I think that plays into some of it. So again, Seth Wickersham from ESPN.com. Mark, should I get him on?
I will reach out.
Again, kind of a...
There's your homework assignment, Mark.
I guess really the first time we've had Andrew Luck on the record with the reasons why he left the game of football.
So just about an hour ago, or maybe a little more than that, but on ESPN.com, the story was released by the New York Times best-selling author Seth Wickersham, who writes, of course, for ESPN.com, who spent extensive time with Andrew Luck. He joins us now. Mark was Johnny on the spot in getting him. So, Seth, first and foremost, thanks so much for your time this morning, and let's get right to it. When exactly was the time period, and how much time, I guess, did you spend around Andrew Luck to be able to come up with this very comprehensive piece?
Hey, thanks, guys. You know, I visited him a lot of times. We spoke late last year for the first time, February, May, July, and September. So those are the times that I saw him.
And you wrote him a letter after his retirement, just kind of saying, yeah, hey, if you ever want to do a tell-all, here I am.
Well, I mean, it was just so obvious that when he retired, there was going to be a lot of ripple effects from that decision. And, you know, any driven person knows that you just don't walk away from something like that. It's something that you have to process, and that it stays with you. And, you know, you built yourself to be a certain type of person, and, you know, now that person is gone and you mourn its loss, and you have to figure out what's next. And, those are the themes I wanted to explore with him. And he wrote me back a very polite email saying, like, hey, I'd love to talk, but, you know, might be 2 months, might be 2 years. I'm not quite sure when. And we just kind of stayed in touch periodically over the years.
Seth, I'm going to do like a book report, and then I'm going to have you grade it, okay?
Okay.
The overall gist, and I want people to read the article by all means, okay? Because there's a lot of great stuff in there, including, you know, like excursions with them and all kinds
tremendous
of stuff.
Detail.
But the overall gist that I took from it, and we were on the air, so I'm kind of skimming it, right, was that Andrew Luck loved the game of football and loved what it afforded him, but Andrew Luck found within him a resentment about football because, in his opinion, to be the best player that he could be, he had to be all in, and he started to resent the fact that football was forcing him to be all in football, which was depriving him being Andrew Luck in other areas of his life.
Well, kind of. I think that it was more he didn't like who he was as that guy. I think that, like, you know, we think about Andrew Luck, remember, you know, he was the guy who could have done anything coming out of Stanford. He could have been, you know, an engineer, an architect, a scientist, whatever it might be, and yet he chose to, you know, devote his talents to football. When in fact he was a very limited guy. He was a junkie. He took that incredibly seriously, and I think he was under so much pressure taking over for Peyton Manning that, you know, he developed a way of living, a survival mechanism that was pretty ruthless. And it was ruthless, you know, not only towards the outside world where he would, you know, sometimes if people were visiting his apartment during the season, he would disappear, go get ready for bed, and come out in his boxers and just say goodnight and turn off the lights, telling everyone, you know, that's essentially how he was telling everyone it was time to go. And even his longtime girlfriend at the time felt like a silo in a siloed life. Like, he just kind of made decisions for her because, as he told me, you know, when you are a quarterback, you know, you simply have to sort of believe certain things, and it's not really the most healthy way to live, and it seeps into other areas of your life. And I think that when he got hurt, all of those things that he had, you know, hardwired himself to be really almost got put into a blender and started spinning faster to the point where he really didn't like who he was as a football player.
Again, Seth Wickersham is with us right now on the Payless Liquors Hotline. Seth Latus, again, really the gold standard for in-depth writing. ESPN.com, Andrew Luck reveals why he walked away from the NFL. First on-the-record quotes we have from Luck throughout the last couple of years. Again, just scanning this, Seth, but I think fans, one of the biggest issues or, you know, just kind of disagreements with Luck is the timing of the retirement, 2 weeks before the start of that 2019 season, and it sounded like Andrew Luck has a lot of regret over that.
I think that he wishes, if he could go back, I think that he wishes he had retired right after that 2018 season. You know, he had come back, he had played terrific, won a playoff game, and I think that he wishes he had just walked away then. He had accomplished everything that he wanted to do. He had come back from the shoulder injury, which derailed his career, and played at a high level. And his foot was bothering him. But he kind of, again, went back to this path of, you know, who he was as an injured quarterback and not liking who that was. And it was a slow reversion, but he was doing it nonetheless. And fast forward years later, he's speaking to a high school football team in Colorado, and he asks questions, you know, for questions. And the first question he gets is, you know, a little kid who asks him, like, well, what's the biggest regret of your career? And he's like, kind of like, you know, cussing in his head. He's like, you know, I wanted a softball. You got to ask me this right off the bat. But he did. He tells this high school team something he had never told the city of Indianapolis or anything until now, which is that he regretted the timing of his retirement.
Most interesting anecdote for you in talking with Andrew?
I mean, there's just a lot. You know, it's hard to pick one. I think that, like, obviously, when he disappeared and he goes to Holland to try to rehab his shoulder midway through the 2017 season, you know, that was some of the reporting I really found interesting because he was working with this trainer named Willem Kramer. And he had known Willem for years through a connection with his dad, but and you know, Willem would come visit him periodically after he hurt his shoulder to massage his shoulder and try to get it ready to go. And finally, like, through the 2017 season where Andrew's not playing, Andrew calls him and says, hey, can you come back and try to get my shoulder in shape so I can try to play this year? And Willem says no. And Andrew Luck was not used to hearing no from people. And he said, you need to get out of that. You know, you're under too much pressure, too much stress. You need to go somewhere where it's just you, Nicole, and your shoulder, and you're working on that. And So he goes to Holland, and the very first day he shows up at this PT facility, he tries to do a drill called Snow Angels, where he has to lift a 2.5-pound weight on his back and, you know, mimic the Snow Angel, and he couldn't do it with his right arm. That's how damaged his right shoulder was. And he's despondent that night, and he just says, you know, I don't know if I can do this. And it took a while, but what Kramer ended up doing was kind of opening Andrew's eyes and letting him allow himself to believe that he was something more than just a quarterback, that he was actually a person, that he was okay for him to express himself and to share how he feels about things. And it was a real transformational 6 or 7 weeks in Holland. And I think that, like, that stuff, learning about that transformation, I think was just one of the most fascinating things that I did in the story.
Seth, you just touched on this, but I wanted to circle back to it because there is so much, I think, in Indianapolis for people, it's not even so much of what Andrew Luck deprived them, if you will, because people feel like they have this, and, you know, like, hey, we were going to win Super Bowls and whatever else, but the manner in which he did it in terms of the timing, I don't have a problem with that personally, but can you elaborate on Andrew Luck's, I guess, retrospective emotion on the time in which he retired, and did it take him a while to perhaps grasp what that meant to the fan base?
You know, it just came together quickly, and he's telling teammates the week leading up to his retirement, and again, they had planned this ceremony. And then it gets out during the game, and I mean, he just felt stuck. The last couple minutes of a preseason game, as we all know, are the longest minutes in sports. And word had gotten out, all the cameras on him, and he had nowhere to go. He could not do anything. And, he ends up rushing off the field into the locker room to tell the team, many of whom didn't know that he was going to walk away. He had told some people, but not everybody. And then, he's rushed up there to give his speech. He goes home that night. And, the next morning, in the next afternoon, he's kind of like in a fog, in a cognitive fog. You know, he doesn't know what to do. What's the first day of my life not as a quarterback? What do I do? He tried to put together a crib for, their daughter who was on the way. Couldn't find where the screwdriver was in the house because, obviously, like, he was always working. He was never putting things together. And finally, that afternoon, he stepped in the shower, and he just started crying. And I think that the profound unburdening, even if he couldn't quite describe all of his emotions, I think really hit him then.
Again, it's a must-read. Seth Wickersham is with us right now. ESPN.com. Why Andrew Luck, and honestly, more than anything, it really is just kind of a time frame over Andrew Luck's entire career. Super introspective and details everything from Luck and his family and those close to him on what he was going through in trying to play the game of football. Seth is with us right now. Do you think he ever entertained any thought of coming back?
Not seriously, but I think that, like, it took him a while, but I think he finally figured out that, he missed the game because he had fallen out of love with it. And then the process of falling back in love with it took a while. It took years. But accepting that it's a part of who he is and that he loves it and that, sports should be part of his life going forward because he didn't know what to do. He was a stay-at-home dad, which he enjoyed doing, but he wanted a career. And he thought about maybe buying into an MLS team, starting a venture capital fund. He thought about joining Ski Patrol because he loves skiing so much. But he ended up like circling back and just thinking that maybe he wants to be a high school football coach. And, I think that, like, again, the process of like trying to allow football back into his life has been something that, that's taken years.
Is there anything he would not answer on the record?
He answered everything.
In terms of that, did he get into, around here, the whole snowboarding accident that compounded his shoulder injury and his love of skiing? You talked
about it. It was an unforced error, but it didn't mess up his shoulder worse. It kind of added to the problem, like you said, compounded it, but it wasn't something that, like, materially impacted his rehab or anything like that. I think that, like, again, his shoulder wasn't working right. It didn't help, definitely. But it wouldn't have changed the trajectory of his career if he hadn't been at snowboarding.
Lastly, Seth, do you feel like in talking to Andrew Luck, is Andrew, and I don't mean this in a snide way at all, do you feel like Andrew Luck now is a guy that is at peace?
I think he's getting there. Again, it's like, you know, wanting to, you know, what does he do for the rest of his life? And, you know, is coaching high school football what indeed he wants to do? I think that that's it, but I don't know. I mean, I think he, you know, he's been under so much pressure for so long. And I think that what he wants more than anything is a little bit of space and the ability to pick his profession and his next step without the overwhelming crush of it being Andrew Luck doing something. And we'll see how that plays out.
Speaking of high school, by the way, Seth, you went to the same high school as the guy that invented Wikipedia. So, did you go to Service High School?
I did.
Yeah.
The guy invented Wikipedia? I didn't know this.
Yeah, so I was wondering, like, did you actually use textbooks, or were you required to research everything via Wikipedia, which is all-knowing?
I had no idea that the founder of Wikipedia is a Service High Cougar graduate. But,
that's right.
Go, know, Cougars, go.
Larry Sanger, yes, Mark Slareth, and yourself, right? All yes, Service, rest, Anchorage, Alaska.
Rest assured that we use textbooks. However, I can't say that I opened them or made the best use of them at all the time during my life there. But, yeah, I had no idea.
Well, I guess on that note, Seth, I will end with this. In 5 years, will Andrew Luck be the head football coach of the Breckenridge Broncos and then a ski, you know, instructor in the, you know, January-type months?
I could see that. I could see that. I mean, I think that also it's not just coaching, it's teaching that I think he has a passion for. Remember his book club. I mean, he's long had a lot of thoughts about, you know, educating young people, and I think that, like, that's something that he'll want to do. I mean, again, he's back at Stanford. He's getting his master's in education, and I think those are, like, the things that he's thinking about in terms of what he wants to do.
Hey, lastly, real quick, we got like 1 minute left, Seth. Did Andrew Luck express any regret or remorse towards, or ill will, I guess, towards Adam Schefter for the timing in which Schefter broke that news? And admittedly, that's Schefter's job.
I think he was disappointed that it got out, because I think that, you know, he's someone who often felt that he wasn't in control of a lot of things in his life. But, you know, it was a huge story. And, you know, it got out when it did. So he didn't get to do his retirement as he wanted, which I think he was disappointed about. But I think that's, you know, that's it.
Seth, outstanding stuff. I hope Indy treated you well. I assume you've made quite a few stops here over the last year or so. Great, great work. And I appreciate you hopping on short notice.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Life is so much more than a diagnosis. It's about sharing time with those you love, hanging with friends who lift you up, and experiencing all those moments that bring you joy. All hits, no skips. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. So long live singing to the oldies, jamming out to something new, and everything in between. Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
9 o'clock hour underway in Indianapolis. For that matter, it's the 9 o'clock hour everywhere in the Eastern time zone. My name is Jake Query, Kevin Bowen here as well. Mark Dykton is flying the ship for us. It's Kevin and Query, 93.5, 107.5, The Fan. Joining us now on the Payless Liquors hotline from The Athletic is Bob Kravitz. And Bob, we want to talk mostly about the Colts and the possibility of, say, Jim Harbaugh, which I think is a very strong possibility for their coaching vacancy, and I don't want to completely blindside you here because I know it's early in the morning for most, but there is an article on ESPN.com where Andrew Luck finally spoke about his decision on why he walked, and it's a very, very, very in-depth article, but essentially in skimming it, what it comes down to is that Andrew Luck basically said, look, my body got to the point where it was affecting the relationship with my girlfriend, soon-to-be wife. They may have been married, actually, at the time. And I think he started to resent football because he realized that the only way that he knew how to have a self-identity was as a quarterback, and it was important to him to start being able to see in himself more of who he was than just a guy that played football. And I don't think that that's necessarily surprising from Andrew Luck.
Not at all. No, I really felt that there are some, you know, so much of what we do is, or so much of what we think of ourselves is, you know, tied into what we do. And, you know, I look, what he was doing was not bringing him joy. And it was making him a person that he didn't like. And he didn't like the person he saw in the mirror. And it was affecting his relationship with his girlfriend, now wife. I said from the very beginning, he did the noble thing. He did the right thing for himself. It sucks for Indianapolis. It sucks for Colts fans. But, yeah, I'll have to take a look at it. I just rolled out of bed. So thanks for the heads up.
Okay, Bob Kravitz with us here from The Athletic. Bob, your latest on Jim Harbaugh and the Colts should pursue Harbaugh. Just kind of the genesis of this story for you. Is this more of a, this is what I think the Colts should do, or I'm hearing some whispers on either side of the ledger there?
No whispers. It's simply me saying that as I look at the landscape of the NFL and of the college game, he's the guy who I think needs to be their primary target. Whether he will be or not, whether he is already or not, I have absolutely no idea. I did reach out to several people who usually put me on the correct road, and I got a lot of no comments. A lot of people who usually tell me what's going on were not saying anything. So that tells me there might be something there. That's just my intuitiveness, my instinct, but I think that if you want to make a splash hire, that it's more than a splash. I mean, Jeff Saturday was a splash, but I don't think he's going to work out. You want to make a splash hire for a guy who's had a ton of success at every level he's been at. I think Harbaugh's the guy. The question is whether Harbaugh would A, want to leave Michigan, which he did last year, and B, come to this crap show, because this has been a complete disaster.
I think, Bob, having nothing to base this on other than just tea leaves and gut feeling, I think Jim Irsay had his eye on, whether it's Jim Harbaugh or not, I don't know. But I feel like when he knew that Frank Reich was not the guy, that Jim Irsay had somebody in mind immediately, and it wasn't Jeff Saturday. But the Jeff Saturday that allowed him to get Saturday in the building, and Saturday knew it. And so Saturday was going to man the ship for him and give him an inventory. But that there was somebody specific that he had in mind, as opposed to simply, I'm going to post this on monster.com and see who applies.
Right. No, I would agree with you. Look, these guys, the minute they hire a coach, they start compiling a list of coaches who are going to replace them. I mean, that's just the way it is. You always have a list of coaches in your back pocket, whether that's the head coach, assistant, coordinators. You always have that wish list at your available to you. And so that would not surprise me. And I think it's Harbaugh. I really do. You know, Jim wants to make a splash. Whoever comes in next, and however it works out with the GM, Jim Irsay has just got to back off. I don't blame the season on him. I think it went south after they benched Ryan. Although, you know, Ryan is, you know, they probably would have lost both those games with Matt Ryan. There are no good alternatives. I hear you guys talking about benching Matt Ryan. I'm like, what difference does it make at this point? They're going to lose every game until they get to Houston, regardless of who they play. I mean, you might as well bring Scott Tolzien back at this point.
Again, Jesus, that's just imagining that makes my eyes start to bleed a little bit there. Again, Bob Kravitz with us here from The Athletic. I want to go back to a point you made a little bit earlier about Harbaugh, and kind of referencing maybe how attractive this job is. I mean, obviously at some level, Bob, it's one of 32.
Right.
But
right.
without a quarterback, without potentially a top 5-7 pick, we'll see where it ends up falling. And the fact of Jim Irsay's actions have been certainly pretty aggressive and meddling here this season, and the awkwardness of like a Chris Ballard, Jeff Saturday front all, like whatever, however that all plays out. Do you think that could cause some hesitancy for, you know, very high level candidates of the Harbaughs or the Sean Paytons of the world?
Well, Sean Payton, when he said he wanted, there are certain dysfunctional franchises that he would not even consider, he was looking directly at the Indianapolis Colts. Directly. I have talked with people in the New Orleans media who know what he was referencing. And I can tell you with 100% certainty that he was talking about the Colts first and foremost. So Sean Payton ain't happening. Harbaugh, you know, like he's going to have better opportunities than the Indianapolis Colts. But what we don't know is, you know, his feelings about Indianapolis, his feelings about the Colts, his feelings about Jim Irsay. You know, he may have very warm feelings towards all of them and want to come back and fix this mess. But from a totally objective standpoint, why would you go someplace where it's been a clown show for all year long? The owner is meddling. The GM is very strong-willed, and you know, there's a likelihood he'll be back. So, yeah, this would not be my first choice, certainly, if I was Jim Harbaugh.
Bob, do you feel like in the last year, you know, Jim Irsay is a well-respected owner amongst people in football. I don't know about necessarily amongst other owners. I think there might be some resentment about him. But do you feel like in football circles in the last year that Jim Irsay has hurt his reputation?
Absolutely. And the thing is, I think that he bolstered his reputation with what he said about Dan Snyder. And then a couple of weeks later, he's mandating the move to Sam Ehlinger, which basically was the end of the season, as far as I'm concerned. You know, you can rip the players all you want, and certainly they deserve to be ripped, but I think that was the white flag of surrender, and I don't think they've ever recovered from that. Yes, I think Jim Irsay has handled himself terribly this season. I say that as someone who likes and respects him immensely, but it is what it is. You know, he mandated the move. He got rid of Reich. He got rid of Bray. I mean, it's, you know, he's trying to sell all this as collaborative, but we're not idiots. You know, we know where this stuff's coming from.
And Bob Kravitz with us here on the Payless Liquors Hotline. Bob, you think better chance Jeff Saturday or Chris Ballard's here next year?
I think both.
You think both are here?
I think both are here, yeah. The whispers I'm hearing is that Ballard is back somehow. Personally, I would blow the whole damn thing up. You know, whether Saturday is the guy or not, I don't know. Again, I like people with experience. You know, if I go in for another heart surgery, I'd like a guy who's done it before or a woman who's done it before. You know, I think we have seen the lack of experience bite Jeff in the butt here in the last couple of games. You know, some of the quotes I've seen, even from Jonathan Taylor, who's, you know, the consummate team guy, talking about not being prepared for some of the curveballs that were thrown at them by the Cowboys, really, I thought were they were focused on the coaching staff. This is just not a very good coaching staff right now. So I think both will be back, but do I have a strong feeling about it? No. But I think they're going to find room for Jeff. I think there's a golden parachute here for him. And I unfortunately think that Chris is going to be back.
I just, Bob, when it comes to Chris Ballard, go ahead. What's that?
I don't know. I'm sorry. I don't know how you sell that to the fan base, but you know, if you can get Harbaugh in here, that would take some of the sting out of it.
Ballard to me looks like a guy that doesn't want to be here. And maybe he does. I mean, I'm not, but just his body language, his everything about it from top to bottom. I almost feel like, and this shouldn't have anything to do with one's football acumen, Bob, but you tell me if I'm being too critical. I feel like Chris Ballard, almost it would behoove the Colts to have him go to like media training. I don't mean that because of us. I'm saying I think fans feel that. Like, I think fans have a hard time buying into the Colts because they're starting to resent just kind of the manner in which he carries himself. But is that am I being too critical?
I think 89% of the time he's been phenomenal with the media, honestly. And somebody,
yeah, I don't mean, when I say media training, maybe I said that wrong. I just, body language training, PR training, you know what I mean? Like just overall presentation amongst, like within the mass communication.
Yeah. I mean, look, the way he acted on the night of Saturday's hiring was really unfortunate, let's just say. He looked like he was undergoing a prostate exam that night, and it was not, it was just not a good look. You know, I have long thought that Ballard would just walk because he's been emasculated by the owner. But you know what? You'll put up with a lot of BS for that paycheck. There's only 30 of these jobs. So I tend to think he's going to stick around for a while because he has amassed some good talent. Unfortunately, they're at all the positions that don't really matter as much.
Yeah, and again, under contract through 2026, I believe.
Exactly. Chris and Powell, remember, they kept Pagano on for an additional year because Jim didn't want to be paying both Grigson and Pagano for doing nothing.
You think Matt Ryan should be benched, Bob? I think there's a financial component that probably supersedes all of that in my thought process there, but do you think we should see the end to his Colts tenure?
Well, somebody's got to explain to me, maybe you, what the financial component is, because Jim has insisted there's no financial component. He's been very outward about that, very adamant is the word I'm looking for. And so what is the financial component we're talking about
so
here?
Jim, I think when Jim has referenced it, he's referred to it as playing time. It's not playing time. There's two bonuses that Ryan's due next March. Roster bonuses that add up to like $17 million. And if he were to get hurt in these final four games and unable to pass his physical, you would owe him an additional $17 million for next season on top of the already $12 million that you've guaranteed him for next season. If he does not get hurt or doesn't play, then you can move him before the start of the new league year and you would not owe him that $17
million. Okay. All right, well, I should have known that, but I wasn't aware. You might, at this point, you might as well throw Slinging Sammy out there or even Nick Foles, the prehistoric remains of Nick Foles. At this point, you might as well.
I mean, it's not like you're going to win with any of them.
You're not going to win with any of them. I mean, you're going to win one game. You're going to beat Houston because Houston's going to be actively trying to, you know, sew up that first pick and get themselves a quarterback. I mean, if the financial component is what you say it is, and I don't doubt you in the least, then you might as well sit them down. But, yeah, I mean, at this point, it makes no difference. You're not going to win with any of those three guys.
Bob, I look at the Colts situation, and I try to be an optimist in terms of thinking about the quick turnaround, and maybe it's Jim Harbaugh as the coach. But then I think about the fact that they have no certainty at quarterback. They have uncertainty still at wide receiver. They have uncertainty on their offensive line. And they have some certainty defensively, but not maybe as much as we thought.
Right.
You tell me, what is the answer here? I mean, how, and they're in a stacked conference. What does the next 5 years look like for the Indianapolis Colts?
Relatively bleak. They got to get you know, their quarterback of the future in this next draft. And I think they sit ninth now. And I was looking at the list, and there are three teams above them that desperately need a quarterback. Although I'm not sure about the Detroit Lions. I mean, Jed, I've heard the Lions are looking, going to be in the market for a quarterback. But Jared Goff just put up 40, and he's having a good season. So I don't know how desperate they are necessarily. But there's some talent here. It's not like the cupboard is completely bare. I think once you get the right quarterback, and that's the rub, I think things will fall into place rather quickly. But, you know, I think we're looking at a 3 to 4 year kind of rebuild because, again, you know, they're good at left guard, but left guard doesn't win you games. They're good in the interior of the defensive line, but that doesn't necessarily win you games in the NFL. So they're in good shape in areas that don't matter. Don't matter quite as much as edge rusher, as quarterback, at wide receiver. Those are the areas where they're found wanting.
Does Jonathan Taylor most benefit Indianapolis over the next two seasons because of the amount of yardage he can accumulate or because of the pieces that he can get them if they decide to move on?
Oh, I would hold on to Jonathan Taylor. You know, I still think he's a special player. You know, I'd be curious to see what happens next year because, you know, second contracts for running backs are really dicey things. We saw it with Ezekiel Elliott. We've seen it with a lot of players that those guys just don't last very long. It's a damn shame, but it's just the way it is. I would hold on to him for the time being. But that's a very good question. It sounds like you gave me a column idea.
Bob, last one from me, shifting over to the Pacers. Considering maybe preseason expectations, you've been more impressed with Benedict Mathurin or Andrew Nembhard?
Wow. You know, we had a story in The Athletic. They asked us all to name our biggest surprise. And, look, I expected Benedict to be a really good player, you know, being the number 6 pick. But here's Andrew Nembhard, who's the first pick in the second round. I think he's 31. He's been tremendous, and he just lit it up last night. I would say that Andrew Nembhard has been the bigger surprise for the Pacers, just given where he was drafted. He's got kind of a chameleon sort of sense to him as far as his game goes. He fits in beautifully with any unit you put out there with him. And he's got kind of this weird old guy game. He's not a great natural athlete necessarily, but he's great in the pick and roll. I mean, just awesome in the pick and roll. And so, yeah, I think Nembhard's been a bigger surprise. And I'll tell you what, that wasn't a bad trade for Caris LeVert.
No.
Well, I'll tell you what, Bob, to me,
still got Nembhard, a first-round pick coming from it.
Yeah, and Nembhard, to me, the thing that has been most impressive with Nembhard is the fact that he seems to be the one who has the greatest understanding, if there are limitations with him, of what his limitations are. In other words, he's not trying to do too much, and that's really, really, really rare to see in a rookie.
I remember texting Carlisle after a preseason game. And I said, you know, I'll clean it up a little bit. But I said, gosh, that Nembhard, he's got this wonderful moxie about him. And we talked on text for a while. He loved his game early on. He could see right away that he was going to fit beautifully. And what a great draft pick by Pritchard and the staff. I mean, you look at some of the deals they made over the years and some of the draft picks. This past 2 years, they've really gotten it together. I mean, Isaiah Jackson hasn't been great, but I think he's going to be a player. The issue is now, guys, they've got to understand it's not about this year. Even though this year is going really well, especially after that you know, the wins against the Lakers and the Warriors, it's still about next year and beyond. So, I mean, as well as Miles is playing, you've still got to move him. Whether Hield is involved in the trade, I don't know. I like what Buddy brings to this team, even though he's a little bit older. you know, but I still think, you know, shooting, you can get really old and be a great shooter and have an impact. So it's going to be interesting. I just hope that they don't fall too far in love with the way they're playing now and decide not to think about the future as it relates to Miles Turner and other players.
I'll say it every day between now and the trade deadline. If Miles Turner's not going to sign an extension, you have to trade him.
There is. There's no question. And they know that. The only thing that worries me is somehow Herb gets involved. And, you know, Herb loves his little team. And suddenly they decide not to do it. I just don't see it happening. You've got to move Miles Turner. And to Turner's great credit, he's been phenomenal this year. He's been the best he's ever been. And, you know, he's got an opportunity that he's never had before. And the fact that he's in a contract year doesn't hurt either.
Bob, always enjoy our conversations. Enjoy the bye week and go back to sleep.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
I'm going back to sleep, boys.
Well, Purdue fans certainly hope these lyrics do not play out for Jeff Brohm with the Louisville opening. Now, Scott Satterfield, Louisville head coach, to Cincinnati. So the dominoes have happened. Luke Fickell, of course, to Wisconsin. Job opens at Cincy. Scott Satterfield goes there. The Louisville opening is now open for the second time in the Jeff Brohm era at Purdue. And to talk more about that, Tom Deanhart from On3.com joins us. Tom, let's start here. I guess when Jeff Brohm made those comments in the spring about Louisville, did that change at all your thinking on if and when that opening were to happen again, how he would view it?
I mean, I think we all along, going back to 2018 when this first flirtation took place, when he almost jumped back to Derby City after this 2 years in West Lafayette, I think at that point we realized the siren song of going back home was always going to be there, was always going to be wailing. And to hear him make comments, you know, like you did this summer, not a shock. It just doesn't seem like it's just an inevitability. It's not if, it's when. I mean, maybe I'm being too pessimistic there, but there's never anything done to really shoot down the potential move back home, is there? There's never any words verbalized. He could come out right now and say, hey, I'm Purdue's head coach, but it's radio silence. We talked to him yesterday at the press conference. You know, he said all the right things, hadn't been contacted. The ball is still rolling. Well, let me say this real quick, too, guys. He was in Indianapolis visiting recruits yesterday. Jaron Tibbs, you know, Gilbert, the big defensive tackle from Cathedral, Dylan Thieneman. Supposed to start visiting recruits further away on Monday. So he's still out working for Purdue, selling Purdue, trying to, you know, secure his commitments for 2023.
Yeah, he certainly did not, you know, close the door on it yesterday with his comments. That is interesting on the recruiting front. Do you know, are there any, he got a contract extension back in April, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Are there any specific Louisville clauses within the contract that you're aware of? And what did that extension entail?
No, there were no Louisville clauses specific to any schools at all in it. I guess the one noteworthy thing, if it's that noteworthy, it's a $1 million buyout. On his end, if he leaves before the expiration of the contract, that's really the biggest thing, I guess, of note. You know, you never want to keep somebody someplace they don't want to be, right? I certainly wouldn't want to be. And you know what? I'll be honest with you, too. If he were to depart for Louisville, I think we would all understand it, right?
Totally. I agree with that, yeah. Tom.
And, you know, 6 years, and you look where Purdue was at before he got here. It was a train wreck. I mean, to use an analogy or a metaphor for Purdue, but it was a train wreck. And what he's done in 6 years is pretty remarkable. So, again, 6 years, he's done his job, guys. he's hit the high mark this year. If he were ever going to drop the mic and leave, this would be the time to drop the mic and leave.
It just seems to me, Tom. Tom Dienhart is our guest from On3.com. Let's talk about, you know, Mike Babinski, who I like a great deal. You have more dealings with him than I, but in my limited dealings, I've liked him a lot. And I remember, you know, initially he and Jeff Brohm almost did like a tour of going around the state to different media people and trying to get people excited about Purdue football. And obviously winning games is what does that, and Purdue has put themselves in that position. But it seemed to me like they were guys that were close enough that Babinski would have had exactly what you're talking about, Tom, an understanding, right, of like, hey, listen, you can't take it personally when the guy's leaving to go home. But is there any possibility that their relationship is not as rock solid, like this is feels like my son-in-law type? And I don't mean in a bad way. I don't mean that they dislike each other. But are they as attached at the hip, seemingly bonded together, close friends, as they certainly seemed in the beginning?
You know, I don't pretend to know the details of their relationship, but from my view, it always seems to be a strong relationship. I see him talking very often. Again, I think there's a lot of communication there. I know they speak every Monday after the press conference. I think Mike probably has another time during the week where he talks to Jeff. So I think they talk, and again, it seems very amicable to me. So I don't think there's any rift there at all. And like you said about Mike Babinski, great guy to work with. Very good with the media. He always returns your calls, returns your texts promptly, and just, again, a guy who gets it. A good fit for Purdue. So, again, I don't think there's any rift there that would cause friction to cause Jeff to leave. But who knows? I got to think this too, guys, right? Mike Babinski knew this day was probably coming, if not now, but sometime down the road. You got to think he's got that top desk drawer with his contacts. He's already probably vetting people, talk to people back channel-wise, and has some people lined up should something pop here, obviously.
So to parlay off that, and I know that we're being speculative, but, you know, hey, for the sake of, you know, it's the holiday season, so we'll sit on Santa's lap here, right, and make wishes for something that we don't even know if they'll deliver. But
hey, Santa always delivers.
That is true. Santa does. But Santa, in this case, might not have to, although I think he's going to have to. So, Tom, are there any names of coaches that came through the Purdue tree that you would look at and say, that guy is probably ready now to be elevated? Or do you think Babinski simply goes with somebody who is long-term established? And if that's the case, who do you think he has an eye on?
Yeah, I'm not sure if there's anybody with direct Purdue ties. That would be a super hot candidate. I guess one that's always one of my favorites, who I think would do a great job, does have obviously great Purdue connections to this, is one of your cities, finest, Kevin Sumlin. Played at Brebeuf, played at Purdue, head coach at Houston and Texas A&M and Arizona. He's in the USFL now. I think he'd take the job, check a lot of boxes, guys. This would be his last job if he got it, come back to his alma mater. I think he would enjoy it. But you know what? People they talked to in the past, before they hired Brohm, guys like Troy Calhoun at Air Force, I think he's always going to be on the radar. Joe Moorhead's at Akron now, but he had a terrible year. But I know they talked to Joe Moorhead last time. Willie Fritz at Tulane, I think, would be a good fit. And, you know, there's some people, too, at Alabama. There's a new associate AD at Purdue named Tiffany Grimes, who worked with Nick Saban. So you look at the people she worked with at Alabama, guys like Charles Huff at Marshall, and even a real big-picture guy like Bill O'Brien at Alabama. I'm not sure if a guy like that would be interested in Purdue or not, but you just keep him on your radar. And there's the typical other names like Matt Campbell at Iowa State. Would he want to leave? You know, Dave Aranda, Baylor, Dave Dorn at NC State. So guys of that ilk, you could go any number of directions here. I do think guys, though, when you think Purdue, right, higher, you probably want a guy who comes from the offensive side of the ball, right?
Well, you know what's interesting, Tom? I mean, agree. A couple of questions here. Number one, does the departing presidency have anything to do with how much flexibility they'll get in their search? Because Mitch Daniels was a pretty sport-friendly president who I think had a really good relationship with those guys as well.
You're right. That's a great, great question. No idea. Wang Chang, I think, is the gentleman's name who's taken over. I've not met him. I'm not sure what his interest is in athletics. He's got an engineering background. Sort of a 180 from Mitch, where he's more of a business guy. Now they got more of an academic guy. So who knows? I can't pretend to know what his thinking is. I'm sure he's being looped in, guys, but I can't imagine he's looped in day to day. He doesn't want to get bogged down in the details of a coach search if it does take place and all the drama that comes with it. But I'm sure he'll be looped in. And I'm sure Mitchell Phil is there and probably fill him in, let him know how he should react and what he's done and maybe how he should move forward too.
Tom, I want to read to you. Tom Dienhart is our guest from On3.com. He's on the Payless Liquors Hotline. I want to read you a tweet that I got, and I guess we can combined react to it. I had said, aside from the obvious factors with Jeff Brohm, one of the things that might weigh into his mind is, in particular, with USC and UCLA coming to the Big Ten, and then theoretically perhaps Stanford and Oregon as well, and the realignment, if you will, of divisions, I had said that Purdue might have, in Jeff Brohm's eyes, hit the glass ceiling of getting to the Big Ten championship game through the West because they're about to realign everything. And so, therefore, things might – that path might have been a once, you know, every eight-year type situation. And somebody said, how in the world can you say he hit the glass ceiling? He made it to the Big Ten championship game with three stars and walk-ons. The ceiling has not been hit. Your thoughts?
Great points on both sides. You look at that roster, you just sort of scratch your head. You go, how did he get eight wins out of that team? How many NFL players are on that roster? So, again, but you know what? I've been around this program, this school, my whole life, seen a lot of incarnations of coaches and programs, and it's largely remained the same. They'll pop up and have their good year every now and again, can never consistently compete with the elite. Sure, Purdue may not be at their glass ceiling, but they're darn close. And I don't think there's much room left. They're never going to be like Ohio State or Michigan. Maybe I'm being too negative about it. But again, I'm with you. I tell you what, with this conference adding those teams from the West, and then presumably going to one division in 2024, top two teams to get to the championship game, I think even the most dyed-in-the-wool Kool-Aid drinker Purdue fan, we have a hard time thinking they got a good shot to get back to that title game. We could be wrong. I mean, crazy things happen from year to year. We see it. But still, boy, Jeff Brohm's got him as close to the top as I think he's probably ever going to get with maybe just a little bit more room to go, possibly.
Again, Tom Dienhart with us on 3.com. Does an outstanding job covering Purdue football. We appreciate his time each of the last couple of weeks with us. I do want to go back to Saturday night. I felt like they played pretty darn well in the first half and moved the football pretty much all night long. It just seemed like I get the fake punt, the fake flea flicker, if you want to call it that, as well. Yeah. It just seemed like one more was needed. One more, instead of settling for a field goal, you needed to punch one of those in to put, I think, real game pressure on Michigan in that second half.
Yeah, 14-13 at halftime, Purdue fans had to feel good, right, going out and drinking their Schlitz and their Black Label at the concourse at Lucas Oil. But then, like you said, they're kicking five field goals. Michigan scoring six touchdowns. You look at the stats, Purdue moved up and down the field between the 20s, dominated time of possession, outgained Michigan as well. But again, the yards get tougher inside the 20. That's where Purdue obviously could not cash in. And guys, you watch football a lot. The listeners watch a lot of football. It's a line of scrimmage game, right? And that's always where Purdue really struggles, the line of scrimmage. Now, the D-line's pretty good, I think. That O-line, though, has always had a tough time matching up and getting a consistent push. I think it's been better this year. They've dealt with attrition, too. But, again, that's where the games are always won. And Purdue just could not impose its will from a run-game standpoint, especially in the red zone. Couldn't impose their will on a very, very good, stout Michigan team. You know what, guys, too? I asked Jeff Brohm in the post game about this, too, and he just sort of looked at me and goes, you know, because Michigan's a pretty good team. And you tend to forget that. You got to give the other team credit, too, right? That's a team that's 13-0 in the playoff.
Early thoughts on LSU in the Citrus Bowl?
Boy, I think they're about a 5.5-point favorite, I believe. I posted something last night about what is Purdue's roster going to look like by the time we get to January 2nd. Who's going to be the coach? So we talk about so many questions that's less than a month away. I have no idea. Purdue, I think it's going to be an uphill battle. But I said that last year when they went to Nashville to play another SEC team in Tennessee. And they found a way that day, guys, without George Karlaftis or David Bell or Milton Wright or one of the starting cornerbacks or starting defensive tackle or starting left offensive tackle. They still found a way to gut it out.
So that was a crazy game.
Crazy game. One of the craziest I've ever seen.
Hey, Tom, I'll tell you what's crazy. Any more there are two phases now for any school in bowl season. The first is the fun of waiting to find out what bowl game you're going to. Mm-hmm. Then the second is to find out the fun of which of your players are actually still with your school.
Or in Purdue's case, coach, potentially.
Yeah. I mean, it's unbelievable, right? Like the... Yeah. I mean, you name the school. Like I mean, I personally, you know, follow Clemson. They've lost, or not lost, but they've had seven players that got minutes, got snaps, that are all announced to the transfer portal. And you think, like, holy cow, they're getting decimated. Then you look around and you go, I don't know. That's like the norm now, right?
I mean, Notre Dame's starting quarterback literally entered the transfer portal.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's too bad because it's supposed to be the celebration, the apex of your season, right?
Right.
And it's just that's what's disappointing about it. You lift weights in July and August. You do all the two-a-day stuff. Bang your head into the wall on Saturdays to win games. And then you get to that point where you get the bowl bid, and then your roster falls apart and your coach may leave. I mean, that's a story that repeats itself across the country each year. And it's just a crazy sport to see the apex again, the climax of your season, be so anticlimactic, I guess. It's just it's kind of sad, really.
Yeah, I know the answers aren't easy, but we've got to define some regulations with some of this transfer portal stuff because it's just too wild, wild westy right now. Tom, I'm thinking about you and the message boards over the next couple of days.
Don't go there. Hey, real quick, too. If something's going to happen, it's got to happen fast, right? Maybe something pops today, tomorrow, but I think something's got to happen quick. But right now, guys, Jeff Rom is still suiting up and showing up and outselling Purdue, so... Just keep that in the back of your mind as we continue to, I guess, fans continue to wring their hands and wonder and worry and wait.
Great info as always, Tom. Thank you.
Take care.